In this episode, we sit down with Dave Lewis, an international angler, a renowned saltwater journalist, and a long-term Shimano saltwater consultant. Hit the like button, leave a comment, and remember to subscribe to the podcast. Let's dive in.
But sticking on obviously with the traveling theme. It's obviously, you know, I still love my British feet sea fishing. Recreationally, I don't do a lot of sea fishing in the UK now, but I love.
What do you do in the UK?
Salmon and trout. I love my bass fishing is pretty much, you know, it would be, you know, one of the bass beaches, one of, you know, rock marks. I enjoy that, but I wouldn't plan to have a day's ray fishing or smooth end fishing, or it's not that I wouldn't enjoy it. It's just that I've done so much of it, you know, there's other things I prefer to do.
So does this tie into, like, taking up fly fishing then, if you're taking...
I've always done a bit of fly fishing, but when I started travelling, I became hooked on the saltwater fly fishing. You know, the bone started off with striped bass with me, actually, but, and the bonefish and, you know, the whole thing of that. And
so it's just meeting other guides while you're over there and you're watching them do stuff and you're like...
A lot of it was going in the shops over there. They got, you know, they call them fly shops, and you go in and they got all these mounts of tarpon and permit and snook and redfish and bonefish and God knows what else all over the walls, and all these fantastic, tackle tart at heart. We all are.
But
I just got into the whole side. Clive Gammon as well. He used to do a lot of saltwater fly fishing, and he used to tell me about fishing for bonefish in the Bahamas and Christmas Island and Christ knows where else. And, you know, I just sort of, you know, the bug took hold, but the whole sort of destination thing has really sort of gripped me now. And these days I'm working exclusively with a company called Spoilt for Choice Travel, and hosting 5 or 6 trips a year for them. And, you know, we're doing a mix of everything. I mean, you know, we last year in November we did Zambia.
This is all fly.
No. Right, okay. No, we do some fly fishing trips, but the Zambia, that was tiger fish, and we do a lot in Central America for popping and jigging. Next week I'm going back to Madagascar. That's popping and jigging. You know, we do trips at a wide range of destinations, and over the years I've got a. They're not clients, they're good friends. Some I've got one guy, a guy called Derek Elliott, Dell. He's been on over 50 long-haul trips with me. You know,
it's a lot of trips.
It's a lot of trips. And I've got a lot of people who have been on sort of 20, 30 trips. And the way it works with Spoilt for Choice is that they've got a fantastic portfolio of destinations. They say, oh, Dave, we'd like you to take a trip to Madagascar. Fine. I know my friends, my clients, the sort of, I know the ones who like the popping and the jigging, and the ones who like the fly fishing, and the ones who like a bit of bait fishing as well, and the others who want to spend a week trolling. And I can construct an email then and send it out to people I know, previous clients, friends, etc., etc. And, you know, they're normally full. You know, we occasionally, you know, get, you know, have to advertise the odd space, but, you know, Spoilt for Choice, I've got a large, huge database of clients as well. And, you know, they normally fill the spot. So I'm doing 5 or 6 trips a year for them. It's supposed to be 3 or 4, but I've crept to 5 or 6. But
is that from when the retirement came in from the fire service? Yeah. You were like, I'm going hosting. Like, this was that a...
That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to travel more. And, it was nice being able to plan trips around optimum fishing times, moon phases, you know, rather than having to manage it around my shifts all the time. And we always used to, you know, work the trips around, obviously, good times. But now, whereas I'd have, you know, my diary for the year would be 4 on, 4 off, 4 on, 4 off. Now I open a diary, off, empty. You know, I do what I want to do. you know, family holidays going first and anything else, and then I can plan the trips accordingly. So that's how we work it.
Do you have any unticked boxes that you want to be like, right, I'd love to do that?
Yeah, too many. Yeah, I don't think you ever get to the end.
Of course, yeah.
You don't. I mean, I've been very fortunate. I mean, I've fished a huge amount of places. I mean, I've actually, a couple of years ago, I qualified for something, an organisation in California called the Travellers Centurion Club. You've got to visit 100 countries that have done that, plus a few. And, you know, fished in somewhere around 60 of them. So
that's mad.
But they're still, I mean, there's one destination. Chile's been on my radar for a long time.
What, big sea trout or?
No, sea fishing. Okay. A couple of bits and pieces, you know, I've picked up, you know, I do a lot of work for American magazines and have done for the last 20, 25, that's another story. But I do a lot of work in America for magazines, and occasionally
you pick up the American magazine. Well, how did they pick you up?
That sort of started with a guy called Doug Olander. He was the editor. No, it wasn't. It was Saltwater Sportsman. They wanted a story on Iceland, and the company that I'd been in Iceland with said that Dave's just been over, and so I did a couple for Saltwater Sportsman, which is the American equivalent of Sea Angler, although the circulation's totally off the scale. And then I got an email from, I was on a mailing list for somebody from a magazine called Sport Fishing that was, the editor was a guy called Doug Olander. And he used to send out newsletters and, you know, to possible, you know, we're looking in, you know, next month we got, a couple of months' time we got a feature on tarpon fishing. Who's anyone got any really good action shots at tarpon? Because the way they do their magazines is very different to the UK market. Most UK or European publications, all of the pictures supporting that article will be been taken by the guy who's written that article or one of his mates. Yeah. Okay? That's not how it works in America. You get commissioned to do the article, and then they source the photos. You get first dibs on the photos. I mean, if it's a destination-specific feature, and I've just been to Senegal, whatever, or Morocco was one of the last ones I did for Mali magazine, you know, they'll use my pictures, but, you know, they might want a killer jumping shot of a white marlin, which I may or may not have. And
is the magazine scene in America still thriving, unlike over here? Is it suffered right across?
Suffered across the board.
Okay.
I mean, Sports Illustrated, the magazine that Clive Gammon worked for, I forget, the circulation's million. I mean, it was massive. You couldn't comprehend this. But this year, it's going to be all digital. They're going to cease doing a paper copy. Saltwater Sportsman, I'm not sure what's happened with that. I think it's changed ownership from Bonnier Corporation, who run Sport Fishing and Marley Magazine. And Sport Fishing Magazine, which is the one that Doug was an editor of, that's gone all digital. Marlin Magazine is the world's premier blue water fishing magazine. That's like a glossy tabletop thing, and that's still up and running. It's the magazines that are really sort of holding their own are the super high quality ones, you know, the expensive ones. I mean, Marlin Magazine, I mean, you know, the boats in there, you know, they're advertising them in like millions.
The Viking 68.
The Vikings, the Rybaviches, the, you know,
the bad,
if the Bertrams, you know.
The Bad Company Boys on,
yes,
YouTube.
Yes, yeah.
That is next level stuff. When you've got 125 foot support ships with helicopters coming in. He's got two Vikings sat on the back of it. I've been consuming their stuff on YouTube. It's just...
That's
what a billionaire owner gets for you, but it's mad that they've taken it to another level of commitment to fishing, those guys.
Yeah, it's I mean, the Americans have been doing that sort of setup for For a long time. I mean, you're talking people with incredible wealth, and they can afford to, buy these incredible fishing machines and then run them. They've got full time captains, they've got full time crews, and they've got full time catering staff. And everything. I mean, we're going from Chile, but Doug Orlander and I became good friends, and once a year, sometimes twice a year, I get invited to go over and do a trip with him. And some of the trips, that he took me on were fantastic. I mean, one of them was a liveaboard boat in Panama. I shudder to think what it would cost to go on it, but it's on the scale of what you're talking about. It's flying to Panama City, night, we stayed in Trump Tower in a suite, each... And then the following day was a private aircraft out to Las Perlas Islands, where at the time there was no lodge. There is a lodge there now, and it's a very good lodge. The mothership was just wow. I mean, it was fantastic. It's just obscene, but total luxury. And then it had a couple of sport fishing boats.
Yeah.
Attached to it with captain's crews. I mean, a live bait well on the back of it, the size of this, full of blue runners, so you don't have to waste time getting your hands dirty and catching bait at the start of the day. The chef would come out at breakfast and ask, what you would like and how you would like your steak cooked, and would you like a sauce with it, and, what sauce would you like, and do you like a lot of garlic or not so much garlic, and, it's this sort of scale, and,
it's a different gravy.
But these are the sort of operations that are keeping these magazines going. It's that end of the market.
Do you not think it's quite sad though? You spoke earlier on about how the magazines, basically, employed you, pushed you to go
to.
Pushed you to go places.
As soon as we haven't got any speckled hen, which I promised. Speckled hen. Anything you want to drink, Dave, just tell me. We'll have it on the table. Yeah, speckled hen would be nice.
I did tell Aaron, he forgot. Yeah. Do you want a Corona?
Oh, come on. No. Do I look like someone who drinks Corona?
But as I was saying, do you not find it's a bit of a bitter pill to swallow when you look at what it was? To what the major angling media is today. I mean, it's so much. So different.
It's so tough for anyone getting out. I mean, I had my breaks, as we've discussed. I mean, I had some great breaks, and I was very fortunate. I was in the position and with the family background to be able to make advantage of those breaks. Somebody starting now, I occasionally get asked, how do I get started? Well, it's so difficult. I mean, a lot of people,
social media has made it,
are going down the YouTube channel thing though, and some John at the Fish Locker, and they're doing it really, really, really well. But again, you've got to get to that level, you've got to be in the position to do it, and you've got to do it properly.
Whole bunch of commitment is taken.
You've got to do it properly. I mean, there are a lot of podcasts out there, and you've done it properly. I mean, you've spent a lot of money on converting this room. I mean, the people watching can't see what I can see, but this isn't a camera phone. This is done properly.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, we've tried to.
A lot of podcasts and a lot of YouTube, and I want to say this in a polite, constructive sort of way, they're not really good enough.
Yeah. I think if you're going to go into something, have to go in with a big brand mentality from the very, very off.
You get one chance to make a first impression.
Very, very true.
If I'm going to click on one of your podcasts and I look, this is a lot of crap. You're not going to do it again, are you? But if you watch something and you do it again and it captivates you, you're going to go back. And a good example for me... Before we go back to Chile,
I want to go back
to Chile because I'm excited.
You've got all the time in the world, don't you worry.
I'm excited about Chile, but there's a guy in America called Andy Mill. He's probably the greatest tournament tarpon fisherman ever. He's won the Gold Cup 5 times. He's won the Hawleys. Won all the big tournaments in the Keys. He used to be married to Chris Evert. He was an Olympic downhill skier, big guy in America. He does a podcast called The Mill House, and it is excellent. I mean, you get all the American, you know, people like Stu Apt, it's gone blank, Jose Wahiba, Mark Sosin, Lefty Craig. I mean, all these massive names, Chico Fernandez, all the very best guys, Steve Huff, you know, all these people, they do podcasts with him.
I'm sure I saw an episode or watched parts of it with Patrick Sabeel where they talked about bits.
These guys.
The Millhouse, yeah. Is that it?
Yeah,
that's okay. I've got my eyes on. But I mean, the one in my morning routine now, I mean, he's done well over 100 episodes, and most of them are an hour and a half, and they've done so well, and they are such a vast array of characters. I mean, you got Huey Lewis there. It's just all sorts of people. The one I watched this morning was a Bohemian bonefish guide named Simon Samuel. But he was instrumental in, you know, a lot of, you know, the early bonefish fishing in Bimini in the Bahamas in the early days. You know, he was friends with Martin Luther King, and he was with him 2 days before, you know, the tragic events, and he did a lot for, you know, it was just a fascinating story. I mean, the Bimini Fishing Club is like, you know, a big thing in the Bahamas. But tragically, you know, for a long time, up as recently as the, you know, the 50s and the 60s, locals couldn't go in there and be served, you know, people of colour. And you know, it's obviously, it's wrong anywhere, but especially when it's your island,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And he spent 41 days, he went there every day and just sat for his lunch hour, because he used to do a trip in the morning and a trip in the afternoon. And for 41 days, he went and sat at the bar for his lunch hour and nobody served him. And then he picked up word that there were a load of dignitaries coming in from Nassau to visit the club and do whatever dignitaries do when they're spending taxpayers' money. But he said, you got all this local meat. He said, right, this is happening tonight. If they don't serve us tonight, up until now, it would have been an absolutely peaceful protest. He just sat at the bar, nobody would serve him. And then when he learned that these dignitaries were coming, he got all his mates, all the local guides, right, we're going in tonight, and if they will serve us, and they did, you know, they all went in en masse, and you know, there was obviously it was hanging in the air that if
it's going to kick off.
Well, no, I wouldn't say kick off, but it might go to the next level up from a peaceful protest. But from that day on, you know, they had the right to go, and you know, quite rightly so.
Do you consume a lot of podcasts? Is that when your go-to things?
No, it's not. I mean, it's very out of character for me. I mean, the Andy Mill one I'm very interested in because a lot of the areas he fishes, a lot of the, you know, the guides and the celebrities and the whole thing, the areas he, you know, the podcasts are based, I'm interested in. I fish with, you know, I know some of the people. I know met quite a few of them over the years. I mean, the one I watched yesterday was based on in Catalina Island off the coast of California, where they got the Tuna Club, the Avalon Tuna Club, and Zane Grey used to fish there, you know. John Wayne used to fish. To be a member, it's the oldest fishing club, saltwater fishing club in the world. It was founded in 1898 and 1899, and to be a member, you've got to be proposed by someone. And then you basically have an interview, and then you're like an associate member, and then you've got to qualify. And then to qualify, you've got to catch, I think it's like a 100-pound yellowfin tuna on a 30-pound line, or a striped marlin of such and such. You know, you had to qualify. And then, you know,
to show your worth.
Yeah, but it's like a big, you know, it's obviously a bit of a snob club thing, but it was interesting to, you know, this guy was in his 80s, and you know, it's just interesting because I'm interested in all that fishery. They were talking a lot about the swordfish that they get over there, and they see them finning on the surface, and you know, they put a bait in front of them, and one time out of 100, the fish will take the bait. And it's interesting.
Have you read about what we had over here with the Tunny Club out of Scarborough?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That, so I've got the book on that.
Yeah,
I've got the like the limited edition.
Yeah, thing. Collector's item. No.
Oh, that.
Yeah.
It's like a 200 quid book.
Yeah, it's worth every penny.
Yeah, yeah. The information in it's the same sort of thing you were reading. You were mentioning about that. We had all the celebrities and like the English gentlemen and stuff. coming up to Scarborough, they were getting rowed out with the, getting dragged out by the herring fleet, and they'd have like two young lads in a rowing boat, matey boy with a hardy rod and reel, and they'd be free lining dead herring off the back of the nets to catch the tuna. It's a super interesting read. It's I've got a thing on the website about the Tunny Club. I want to do something with it, but it's
I read a lot and I like the old stories, you know, and
I want to get my hands on one of those rod and reels, but it's just.
I've had my hands on when I did a feature on a guy called Sam Harris. He used to be a journalist in the Northeast. He died last year. I went fishing out of at Tynemouth with him back in the 90s, and he turned up with this rod just to show me. And you know, the reel was this big, Hardy's Ain Grey, and the rod, and you know, the
crazy
whole,
money.
Whole
you just can't
thousands,
get
thousands.
Yeah, you just can't get hold of them.
Yeah, thousands.
They don't even come up. Before they even come up, they're already whisked off into a private collection. I would like one in here, but it's just, I can't get my hands on it. But there's time. There's always time. So back to Chile. Tell me about Chile.
Just finish off on the podcast.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, Danny made the point about the magazines. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is, as much as, you know, magazines have been great for me, they've been great for a lot of people, and
it's just not how stuff's consumed anymore, is it?
It's not how stuff. I think there's always going to be a place for magazines.
Of course.
But they're gonna,
I love a magazine myself.
I would rather flick through a magazine than anything.
Do you know Subsurface Journal on the carp fishing side? Gaz Farum?
No.
Have you seen what he does? So no. He's got this thing that print isn't dead, he says.
Mm. It's a quarterly, isn't it?
Yeah, so they do a quarterly. It's beautiful.
There are several fly fishing magazines on the same genre. And, you know, maybe. You know, hopefully, you know, sea angling in the UK will.
He does a lot of books as well. You know, he just brought out another one. He's got but it is a dying thing. But like on the podcast front, you can't sit in your car for 3 hours and read a magazine.
No.
Whereas now you can chuck a podcast.
But it's got to be done. The point I'm making is that there's a lot of them out there, and I sort of flick around, have a cup of coffee and look at a couple of YouTube things, and usually, you know, 2-3 minutes in, I'm switching off, you know. It's just can't watch it, you know, it's unwatchable. But there's some very, very good ones as well, and it's the good ones that are going to sort of drive the way forward. It's the same in the magazine world, even in the 80s and the 90s. I mean, I don't know how many magazines have come and gone in the time that I've been working with magazines, you know, sort of Course, Game and Sea. They come and they go and they come and they go, and you know, and you can see. And I don't want to sound critical because
feel free to.
I do though. Don't
No, I don't mean? because these people have tried, and you know, they've tried to do something and it hasn't worked, but it hasn't worked for a reason.
Yeah, I learn from your mistakes. So the only way you'll learn is from a mistake. If you put everyone's got to start somewhere. When me and Aaron did this, we said at the very beginning, we've just got to start and we've got to put something out.
It's got
to
be done properly.
But we were very conscious about what we were going to put out.
Yeah.
I know this was as good as I could find with Danny. But, you know, it was like I phoned Danny up to do the interview. I wanted to interview him to start with. In like the enthusiasm.
You were clutching at straws, weren't
you? Yeah, well, he was top of the list. This is as bad as it was. This is as good. This is as good as it was.
You can't even organise a decent beer for his guests.
Yeah, I know. So I am. I'm embarrassed about this, to be honest, mate.
Well, I'm sure you should be.
I am.
Yeah,
you're gonna have to go up Sainsbury's, mate. I can't live with this any longer. But like, I reached out to Danny for it. And the enthusiasm that came out from him about it.
He's one of the most enthusiastic anglers I've worked with. And I've worked a couple of shows with Danny now. And I don't really want to big him up in any way. Whereas I'm of the genre where I want to slope off the stand at every possible opportunity. And, you know, Danny's there from the start of the show to the end of the show. Chop, 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 chop. He's talking bollocks, but he's engaging with the people.
He can come into a bollocks with me. It's
and he works, you know. And if
if
you're good at it, as I am, and Danny obviously is, people will know you're talking bollocks. So anyway, Chile.
I appreciate it, Dave. Actually, I mean, like, thank you.
You know, you work. I mean, especially it was the last week. It was Fairham, wasn't it? I mean,
what was the Fairham show?
We were big there one. As Shimano. It was the big one show.
The Shimano show.
Yeah,
we won again the display of the show, didn't we? We won the best stand.
A couple of things.
So, but yeah, I was on the modern lure side of it.
Right, mate, it's not about you. You were
But no, it was part of Shimano, and it was a good little stall. And like I say, it's a. It can be hectic, can't they? They're 10 hours on your feet. You're being pulled left, right, and centre. Well, that is on the Shimano stand.
Yeah.
People don't realise how hard it is working those shows. It is really seriously hard work.
We've said next year, we'll try and get some in this year, but next year, I think we're probably going to do some like mini episodes where we're going to go to the shows with the camera and we're going to talk about the shows.
Bring my videographer up and just...
I think it'll be great.
Some people in front of the microphone.
We're going to come find you, Dave, on the stand and hassle you for a bit.
Well, that'll go. I might be in Chile. Have I told you about Chile?
Yeah.
Okay, Robinson... Right, Chile... It's been on my radar for a good few years. I'm always looking for the next good place. And, you know, I've been fortunate. I've managed to get into places, several places. And we've just talked about Namibia. We've talked about Norway. There's a few other places where, yeah, I put my hand up. You know, I've been the first to really sort of get in there and get the articles in the magazines. And as a journalist, photojournalist, it's always, they're the articles that you can sell to the different magazines around Europe, in America, in the UK.
Better price with that as well? Or just get them sold?
Not always a better price, but you will get into the better quality magazines, okay. And they, by definition, they you know, you get a better fee for them. But it's always the new stuff that's easiest to sell and more exciting. But Chile's been on my radar for a long time, and originally it was Easter Island. I was very keen to visit Easter Island, as much to visit Easter Island and you know, and see the statues and, you know, just another tick off the country's thing, Chile.
Stamp the passport.
Yeah, but the fishing there apparently has gone down the pan. It's been overfished commercially massively. And I looked at a few places, shore fishing operations on the coast, because they got a lot of species there that, you know, you don't get elsewhere, or you don't get commonly elsewhere. And the Pacific halibut they get down there, and also they get a corvina, which is like it's also called a white sea bass, which is like the corbiello we were talking about in Namibia, you know, the big underpound. They get that. But then Robinson Crusoe Island clicked into my head, and I started picking up a few bits and pieces on Facebook and social media. Robinson Crusoe Island. Robinson Crusoe, the film and the story and the TV series, is based around Tobago. Okay? The inspiration for that came from Robinson Crusoe Island, which is part of an archipelago located 400 miles off the coast of Chile, directly due west off Santiago in the Pacific. It's there that a mariner was shipwrecked, washed up, survived for a couple of years. His hut is still there. But that's why it's called Robinson Crusoe Island. Part one. Part two, Robinson Crusoe Island and the archipelago 25 years ago were designated as a conservation area. It's like a mini Galapagos. Like no commercial fishing, sport fishing strictly controlled. I started seeing pictures of these big yellowtail kingfish. I've never caught one. I mean, you get a few in California, they get a few in Mexico on the Baja Peninsula, Australia, New Zealand, they get, you know, they're a popular sport fish, one of the big sport fish.
Unreal fighters.
Everyone tells me, pound for pound, it's the hardest fighting fish they've hooked. Now, a big one is like 20, 30 pound. Now, I started doing a bit of digging on YouTube, Robinson Crusoe Island, sport fishing, Google it, look. And I'm just saying to the viewers, if you want to see some...
We'll have it up on air, it's fine.
Jesus, you want to see... They're catching these yellowtails, and there's fish 30, 40, 50, 60 pound, double hooker, triple header, double hooker, triple hookup. There's some drone footage of a guy working poppers, and there's like, you know, 20 or 30 of these things coming in. There's underwater footage, and it's just masses and masses and masses of fish. And they're fishing just off the island. Then there are several species of trevally. There are several species of tuna, yellowfin and southern bluefin. I've seen video footage there of mako sharks, marlin, massive halibut. And species I've got absolutely
spin your passion into a business with Shopify.
You just see some of these, but just the scale of the fishing. And when you watch a promotional video on a destination, you can't help but when you've got a bit of experience, you can't help but watch it with a critical eye. You know when they're actually maximizing on a few fish and trying to make it look like a lot of fish. This is just off the scale. Just watch some of this and, you know, some of the fish they're catching. And it's just fish after fish after fish after fish. Yeah, anyway, working with Jason Heeman and Christine at Spoil for Choice Travel, we contacted these guys, and I'm hosting the first trip there the end of January next year, and I haven't been this excited about visiting a new destination for, you know, yellowtail kingfish. I've not been this excited about fishing a new destination for a long, long time.
Quite light for them, don't they?
Yeah, they're super powerful rods. I mean, they're like the slow pitch jigging rods, you know. And but you know, there's a picture. There's one.
Are you hosting, or are you just going fishing for you over on this one?
I'm hosting. I'm taking. I'll be doing a bit of fishing as well. I mean,
how many guys are you taking out?
It's me plus. I think it's a total group of nine. The way it works on the hosted trips is that I fish when I can fish. I'll always get a chance to fish every day, and some days I'll get to fish all day, some days I won't get to fish. Look at the size of that thing. I mean, how big's that? I mean, that's well over 20, 30 pounds, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's a specimen size in areas where these are caught. Yeah, it's just one after the other.
You know, Dave Morco was saying about the amberjacks.
Yeah.
Those will pull them backwards.
Mm-hmm.
They'd piss all over them, and you saw what Dave got put through with those.
Yeah, yeah.
Those were literally...
That's a southern bluefin tuna. It was like a yellowfin or a big eye. I mean, there's so many different... I haven't seen this particular one. I want to watch this now. Stop talking.
This is what happens when we do these. It all goes quiet because we just start watching fishing videos.
Obviously, look at that. What a place to
for
fish.
For the listeners, I'm just going to explain what we're doing. We've actually got a YouTube video up where it's covering the island and some of the fishing scenarios. And we're just watching like a load of collages of various fishing trips.
There's bigger ones of these as well.
It's the fact it's all going back, which is amazing, isn't it? So for those guys, so for this hosting trip that you're doing, how much have those guys paid?
The trip's full. We haven't finalised the final price yet.
It's just agreed to go.
Yeah. We know it's a top end trip. It's going to be 6,000 in that bracket.
For how long?
You're going to have seven nights on Robinson. Well, it's an overnight British Airways flight to Santiago.
Yeah.
And it's the longest direct flight British Airways do. You have a night in Santiago, then it's a private plane out to Robinson Crusoe, which is $900 per person. So, you know, you're in for like $2,000 already with flights.
Yeah, at least,
And then there's seven nights on Robinson Crusoe. Obviously, their prices are premium. They're located 400 miles out in the Pacific. Everything's got to be shipped in. Everything's, you know, it's like any island anywhere, you know.
Channel Island cities.
It's what it is. It's an expensive trip. But it's
a pretty reasonable trip for that.
I mean, you're both lifelong. How many sea anglers do you know fishing in Chile?
None.
Me neither. And this, again,
as a well-travelled angler, yeah.
It's only the last couple of, months I've been away to Robinson Crusoe, and the last couple of weeks that we've really sort of driven this project forward, and it's going to happen. It's happening.
Well, like when you mentioned Chile, my first instinct was my only recollection was that
salmon
is the big sea trout angler.
Salmon trout and sea trout.
So
is that trip full? I'd be coming with you. I'd but just sign me up now. I'll go.
No, it's.
When's the next one?
I don't know. I mean, this is like an exploratory initial hosting trip. I mean, at the moment we've got the names. If we get a vacancy, I'll certainly give you a ring. But
I know two other guys that will come as well.
this is what happens.
I could take three spots off that trip now.
Right. Well, Jason Heenan will almost certainly be hosting it. I'll hopefully be going back as well. But
I want a bit of that.
Yeah, do you want to see some of the when you get home? Look at some of the other videos. There's better videos than that. I mean, that one we just picked up quickly off. But go through some of the others, and it's just incredible stuff. I mean, marlin, mako sharks.
It's that first of a new fishery again that really excites me.
And that's the key. That's always been the key. I mean, at the end of the 90s, again, as a result of the improvements in tackle, giant trevally GTs came on the agenda. The reason they became so popular then is because they were pretty much uncatchable up until the advent of proper
gear, yeah.
Proper rods, proper reels, braid, hooks that didn't open up like paper clips, split rings, that didn't open up like paperclips. You know, it's brutal fishing, GT fishing, and any of the stuff in these tropical reefs. You know, they're powerful fish, and they like wrasse, and they're going to go straight. They know exactly what they're doing when they hook them. That's why it's so brutal. It's not that they're such incredible fighters. They're dirty fighters. In open water, the GT is no more than a tuner of a similar size. You know,
what Dave was doing in Spain. I was going to try and get... He came out with us yesterday, Dave, a mate of mine, who was like our first guest on the podcast.
Dave Mordecai.
Yeah.
Hey, Fish, Dave.
Great guy.
He spoke very highly of you, Dave. When we said we were getting you on, his eyes lit up. So.
Yeah, his eyes lit up. He was like, ask him this question, ask him that question.
It's amazing what a tenner does, no?
Yeah. The problem is I drunk so much Stella, I couldn't remember. Spoke very, very highly of you. But when we had him on, we had some of the videos of him doing GT fishing. He's just getting absolutely beasted.
It's brutal. It's brutal.
Yeah, it looked amazing.
So you've travelled a fair bit. You've got some amazing stories. And so how long did it take you to figure out that you liked, obviously you're writing the features. When did books become a thing for you?
My first book was published in 1995, and it's by a company called Ward Lock. It was an estuary fishing. Second one was in a series of books, and that series was dinghy fishing. And then the third one was cod fishing. That's why I came to Iceland, because I contacted the Iceland Tourist Board, and you know, I wanted to do a bit of cod fishing in different places. It's interesting to read what I wrote about Norway then. This is way before I ever went there, and it's something along the lines of, you know, not much information is available on Norway, but without a doubt the potential's there, and one day it's going to happen.
Of course,
it happened.
There's a nice chapter in here I've just flicked through about it.
And then... that book, it's a vanity project.
I was just about to say, I mean, financially, is it, or is it just something that you're enjoying doing?
I enjoy doing it. I wanted to do it. I had all these, you know, pictures that I thought were nice. And
these are all pictures that you've taken?
Yeah, they're all mine, yeah.
So were you approached to do this, or did you go and chase that?
No, I floated the idea to several publishers. A couple would have published it, but they wouldn't publish it in the format I wanted. And I didn't want to do it unless it was in that format.
A proper hardback.
I wanted a proper hardback. I wanted a nice quality dust wrapper. I wanted quality paper. I wanted it to be right.
You can feel that as you're just flicking through it. That's
ones you've sent me, when I first read them, and I was like, actually, they are, when you feel them, they are quality.
I could have had it done in softback and, you know, with less colour, but I didn't want to do that. So in the end... I was introduced to a guy called Martin Mumby, who owns a company called Y Valley Publishing. And basically, you work with Martin and you self-publish.
Yeah.
And he's
a self-funded exercise.
Yes, totally self-funded. And then you've got to, you know, but each one of these is 350 limited edition, all individually signed and numbered. And... you know, it didn't take long to cover costs.
I like that. That's a nice touch.
It didn't take long to cover costs. So I covered my costs. So what's happening?
Just going to show it to the camera now.
So once your costs are covered, that's it. You've broken even. But there's, you know, the hours that go into that.
I bet.
You can't begin to... equate it to even the most basic magazine. You're not going to make money on it. But I did Destination Angler, and then that went down really well. And then I still had a stack of material. So I did Destination Angler 2. Then we had lockdown, and I was planning Destination Angler 3, but lockdown sort of forced my hand. I mean, suddenly, I had a massive time on my hands. So that a lot of that was written in lockdown. I said I wouldn't do another one, but I got so many.
Yeah, of course.
Great destinations. Obviously, Chile's on the way. But you know, since that's been published, I've been to Trinidad, where they've got the best tarpon fishing in the world. There's nothing to touch it. And if I told you how good it is, you think I was telling you absolute bull. You know, you would not believe how good the fishing is there. Spot for choice destination again. I'm hosting a trip there in November this year. It's off the scale. I mean, it's like the Florida Keys would have been 200 years ago, never mind 50 years ago.
And I've been able to do that, and it's insane. So when you ramp that up, I can only imagine.
It's ridiculous. What's I've been to the Dominican Republic, Senegal, and there's a few other places, which, you know, really good, you know, great fish and great things. But the key thing for me is the fishing I've started doing in Mallorca, which people, you know, most serious British sea anglers would turn their nose at Mallorca. I mean, what's there? Sun, sea and sangria and a load of lagalotes.
The first thing that just popped into my head as you were saying that.
Incredible fishing. Right,
like Dentex and stuff like that, is it?
Oh, no. Bill fishing.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Bill fishing tuna. I became aware of a guy called Vince Riera. He runs a boat, Mad Max, out of a place called Alcudia on the northeast of the island. And he was posting a lot of pictures of spearfish. Now, you're aware of the IGFA, International Game Fishing Association. They have their grand slams, you know, for catching three of a species, four super slams for catching four of a species, fantasy slams for five. Then they've got their royal slams. And a royal slam of billfish is nine species of different species of billfish. That's Atlantic blue, marlin, Pacific blue, black, striped, white, marlins, Pacific and Atlantic sail, broadbill swordfish, and a spearfish. Spearfish is the hard one. The majority that get caught are caught as a bonus catch. I mean, they're widely spread all around the tropics of the world. There are a couple of species in the Pacific, Indo-Pacific region. You've got a short-billed spearfish. In the Atlantic, you've got the long-billed spearfish with a couple of subspecies, which is a round scale, and a Mediterranean spearfish. Now, I wanted to catch a royal slam of billfish from day one in Kenya. They had a picture on the wall, and you know, I'd love to do that. But the spearfish is the hard one. You've either got to be very lucky and catch one when you're fishing elsewhere. Well, I've fished in a lot of places where they catch one, and I'd never seen one. Or you go to Hawaii, where they get the short-billed spearfish, and you've got a good chance to catch one there. But obviously, again, Hawaii is like a major undertaking. American charter boats, you're talking a couple of grand a day, and there's still no guarantee you're going to get one. Then I hooked up with Vince Riera, and he actually said the words, "You want a spearfish, you come to Mallorca, I will catch you one." Now, this is in lockdown. The first time that lockdown eased would have been 21. Was it 21 lockdown? Anyway, as soon as lockdown eased and Spain opened its borders, I was there. This is where the Lucky Lewis thing comes into the equation. I went fishing with Vince, day one, steamed to the area that had been producing spearfish, put a spread of lures out, boat's mine, and you know I'm working as well. I'm hoping to get a feature for this for several magazines. So the lures out, we start fishing. I'm sat down, rod on the left side. Starboard side, but left as you're looking back. I jumped up. I thought, what was that? Jumped in. I thought, it's just sort of start of the trip nerves. I thought it's the lure just pulling through a swell or something, but it was pretty flat. So I kept me on this rod, and tip over.
Is this like these resin head lures with the?
They're small things. This sort of size. I mean, spearfish are like 10, 20, 30, 40 pounds as an average. But there was a little lure on the end. It was like a little sailfish, a little wahoo lure, Dorado lure, that sort of thing. Rod over, line screaming, fish jumping. 10 minutes later, I'm holding my spearfish. That's where the Lucky Lewis thing kicked in. Vince and I became very good friends. I went back a few times. We did some night fishing for swordfish. Most of his business is bluefin tuna fishing. He does a lot of that, and they get a lot of very big fish. They're catching them there right now. They get all the Dentex you mentioned. He also gets a lot of amberjacks, big amberjacks, 100-pound plus amberjacks. I mean, the fishing off there, you would not believe what is available 2 hours from Bristol Airport.
Of course, yeah.
Dave's just come back from one of the islands down.
He's just come back from La Gomera.
Yeah, La Gomera,
which is one of the Canaries.
We're going to go out there in April, me and a couple of other people.
But talking with Vince, I mean, there's so many spearfish there. I mean, you know, he's been the number one captain with the Billfish Foundation for the last 5-6 years, tagging long-billed spearfish, you know, the Atlantic species. I mean, it would be great for you to catch these on fly. You know, Mediterranean spearfish had never, ever, ever been caught on fly before. There's a few being caught around the world, but again, it's always when people are fishing for marlin or they're fishing for sailfish. All of a sudden, it's a spearfish. That's how they caught, with the exception again of Hawaii. So we had he said, come on, let's give this a go. So we went, and we had 2 days to do this in between his charters, because this is how I tend to, you know, to do it with Vince, is I get a phone call, right, I've got a break, you available, we can do it now, rather than planning, you know, months in advance when you don't know the weather's going
to be. Sometimes like, the best session, isn't it? Just go.
Just go. So he came in, he said, right, the spearfish are here, the weather's good. You know, I got over there, the first day we had 8 shots. Fish coming up, and the first couple weren't really aggressive. The way you fish for billfish with a fly, you fly fish. People say it's not proper fly fishing. I can show you it is. You troll hookless teasers and baits. Okay? Billfish comes up, starts whacking the baits. It's very much a team thing. The rod's there, ready to go. You're not to do any casting until the fish comes up. Everything, the line stripped out. You know exactly how much line stripped out. You know exactly where you want the fish. As soon as the fish is raised, the crewman grabs the rod that the fish is interested in. Remember, there's no hooks.
Yeah.
Lets the fish have a little taste of the bait, because you're trolling as a bait and they can taste it, you know, and then pull it at the mouth, wind, you know, 10 yards, get it closer to the boat. Fish comes in, it's getting really aggressive now, has another taste, pull it at its mouth again. At the same time, the skipper is slowly reducing the revs, so the boat's slowing down. And then when the fish is perhaps 30 feet, 20, 30 feet behind the boat, in the predetermined area where we've decided that's where we want the fish, I'm now in the port quarter of the boat, which is the right-hand corner. The crewman teasing is in the opposite corner. Shout, now when I'm ready. At that point, the boat goes to neutral, which has got to be an IGFA legal catch. The crewman rips the teaser out of the water, and I've got to put the fly alongside where that bait was. And then all of a sudden this thing looks at it, I'm going to have that. Well, the problem we had on the first day I fished, and I said we raised six, I think it was six or seven on the first, six or seven. The first fish, they were just too happy. They weren't aggressive enough. They were just tap, tap. You could just tell by their body language that they, you know, they were tap, tap, and you cast the fly out and they swim around and look at it, and, you know, they weren't really interested. Then I had one come in that was obviously a lot more aggressive, whacked the fly with its bill, did a circle, and then with an absolute display of incredible skill that I can't believe, just as the fish was going to come back and inhale this thing, when the fish circled, I thought it was swimming away, and I was getting ready to recast and put the fly in front of it again. But what was happening, he was circling to come back, and I got to the point of the cast where I couldn't stop myself, and I pulled the fly straight out of the fish's mouth. And then I thought, hang on a minute, this is the way this has got to be done. So the following day, we decided, right, this is how this is going to work. And the first couple of fish came up again, nothing really hot, nothing really aggressive, sort of taking the fly. Then I had another fish come up, and this you could see this was going to eat something, it wanted something. Did what we said, he whacked it with his bill, I let the fly sit. As the fish did its circle, exactly the same as the other one the day before, I just twitched the fly a few times, just the slightest bit of movement in the water, he stunned his fish, and it's wham, grabbed it, went off, threw the hook straight away. I was gutted, and I thought, oh, that's it, that's my chance. Remember, these have never, ever, ever been caught by anyone before, never. And I thought that was it, but no, it wasn't. We had another one come up, and did exactly the same thing again. Smacked the fly with the bill, let it sit. Did the circle thing. I did the twitching thing. Came back, inhaled it. The fish turned, set the hook. Phew, job done. So we got the first ever Mediterranean spearfish on fly.
Yeah.
job done hooked. What was the fight like?
It was fish was 20 pound. I mean, it was on a saltwater fly rod. I mean, it was a fight. It was a good, you know, fighting, exciting fish. Terrifying is the word I'd use to describe it, because I'm hooked up to the fish that, you know, we've gone for. Yeah. I'm just waiting for something to go wrong, because I've done a lot of sailfish fishing with fly before, and, you know, a lot of other big game saltwater fly fishing. And with the IGFA leaders, there's so much that can go wrong.
Yeah.
You know, that stage, you know, you're just waiting for it. I just wanted to get it, but we got it. And, you know, it was a...
I've seen the picture of you.
Yeah. Well, that's
was that a record? That was a record.
That was an IGFA world record.
How many? So how at that stage? Because you didn't with the Ling. How many world records have you held?
I don't know. I couldn't claim this one because two reasons. One, I didn't want to kill the fish just for a record. And two, you're not allowed to kill billfish in Spanish waters. Period. They've got to be released from a sport fish. So I was happy we were going to release it from day one. It was a first. It was definitely a record because it was a first, and you know, no.
Yeah, fair play.
The second one was caught 2 days ago on the same boat. So you know, that was a bigger fish.
Never understood why they haven't followed the freshwater thing, and I've said this loads of times.
Oh, it's just so it is.
There's multiple ways of weighing it, verifying it.
Well, what the IGFA know? They've got a length category. You can have you as long as you've got an official IGFA weighing mat, and you measure it to there against the rules. No, we were just trying to do this thing.
This is proof of concept for you.
Next time I go, we will have one. But anyway, so I had the world record, met it, you know, but I'm not really interested in killing fish just for that. And it would have been killed, wasted, because the fish that was caught 2 days ago was clearly at least 10 pounds bigger than mine. So my fish would have been killed and I'd have gone through the record process and then lost it straight away. So... But I got the first one and we proved that it could be done. I got some great articles. I had 7 or 8 page in the IGFA yearbook on the fish, and another thing in Marlin magazine, and the amount of Americans that are coming over now specifically.
Has this now created a fishery?
Yep. Definitely. But then
you're going to do more of?
Yeah, on the next level. And the next level was broadbill swordfish. Okay. Now, broadbill swordfish are the ultimate billfish. Okay, they're the hardest. You know, they're the most esteemed. They're the ones that everyone wants to catch. You know, I've caught them before. I've had three before in Kenya, but that's fishing bait at night.
I was just saying, how do you get over the depth? Are they coming up
at night? They come up.
Yeah, and you're fishing under lights. Yeah.
No. Right. There's several ways you can fish for broadbill swordfish. During the daytime, they're normally down like 1,000 more feet. But at night, squid rise to the surface to feed on phytoplankton. And squid are the primary food source for swordfish. And they come up.
Follow the squid, yeah.
Follow the squid. Occasionally, in some areas, you see them finning on the surface, but they'd almost never take a bait.
Yeah.
So you've got two options. You either deep drop in the daytime, which they do a lot in Florida now, and it was actually started in Venezuela. But that's not really a style of fishing that appeals to me. They're using 12-pound concrete blocks that as a weight, and they're designed to break off, and a lot of it's done with electric reels. It's not really how I like to fish. A lot of the time, you know, you're fishing 1,200 foot down, and you don't even know you've got a fish on the end until... Because when you start coming up, the fish is going to fight against the line of direct resistance. So the fish is going to come up as well. So as you're winding up, the fish is coming up, and you don't even know you've got a fish on. And, you know, so that's not for me. The way they fish them in Kenya, and they pretty much pioneered it there, is fishing at night exactly the same way as they do with sailfish, which I subsequently learned how to hook occasionally. Tuna strips. Dorado strips or squids rigged, and they fish at night on a moonless night. It's got to be a moonless night, and I'll come on to that in a minute. And they slow trawl two baits. One's on a flat line, which is on the surface. The other is on a downrigger, 30 or 40 feet below the surface. In front of each lure, they've got a Siloom light stick, and that adds as an attractor, but it also adds an indicator so you can see what's going on. And the fish comes up, and the first you know that a fish there, you're like, the ratchet goes, you know, on one of the reels, and then you pick it up, and then you can feel the same thing, and then... You know, so I caught swordfish doing that. When I started exploring the idea of revenge. We got the, we got the med spearfish. We thought, let's get a swordfish. Never been caught on fly before. There are only five people in the world who have caught a swordfish on fly. I'm no one of them. The first one was caught in Kenya by a guy called Jeremy Block. He subsequently got the world record. Well, he had the world record, 54 pounds, up until a few months ago. Only another three anglers in the world have caught them. One is Roy Croker. He's very rich American. He does a lot of fishing all around the world. Big fly fisherman. I couldn't afford to do a fraction of what he does. But he's had six, and that's how many he's caught. Everyone else, I think, has had one or two. I think Jeremy's had two or three. Then there's Fouad Sahoui. He's a Moroccan, again, a very rich guy. He's done a lot of, really done a lot of bill fishing with a fly. He used to fish a lot with a guy called Billy Pate. And almost all the white marlin records on fly are his. And he's got his own big boat, and he takes it under Cape Verde. And the other guy is a guy called Martin Rostagui. He's a very rich surgeon or something from America. And these are the only people who've caught one of these things on fly at night. So this fireman from the Welsh Valleys or from Newport now is gonna have a go. Vince was totally confident that we could do it. All right. In January this year, he gave me a phone call. He said, "Dave, this is on a Monday." He said, "Get your ass over here now. Everything's right. It's a full moon." Which is the opposite of what I said earlier. Conditions are absolutely perfect. We got a great chance. I'd already, because I'd been over there with him night fishing before, and we've caught swordfish on. His clients have caught swordfish, and I've been on the boat as a journalist. And I said to him before, I said, "Well, why? In Kenya they won't, any moon at all. Forget it." He said, "There's a big difference. In the Med, there are no sharks. In the Indian Ocean, on the North Kenya banks, where they fish is crawling with white tips, oceanic white tips, and that's the big difference. The swordfish will only feed actively in the higher surface layers on the blackest nights when, that's...
when they're not part of the food chain.
Part of the food chain. So he said, "No, trust me," he said, "my information is from longliners. Their best results are on the surface at night on a moonlit night." So we went out on the Thursday. I flew to Mallorca. We went out on that evening, raised the fish almost immediately. Go back to Alison, my wife. Again, this is how supportive she is. I almost didn't go. I said, it's such a bloody long shot, Alison. I said, "Over there, everything's shut down on the island. I mean, it's this or nothing." And she said, go. She said, "I've got a good feeling about this." So I went. The first night, we raised a fish up, very aggressive fish. You could tell it was aggressive. I knew it was aggressive because the guy teasing it, it's pitch black now. Well, it's black, it's night, but it's still, the moon's coming up. So you still see a bit of what's going on. You can see the light and you can see everything getting knocked about in the water. And they pulled the teasers out. I put the fly in, nothing. Second one came up. We teased the second one about an hour later. And nothing really, he just wasn't interested. It wasn't, So we had two shots the first night, nothing. The following night, we went again. The sun was still above the horizon and the moon was just coming up. And we'd been fishing for about 10, 15 minutes. The bait's out, whack, something's happening. We thought, "God, surely it's not a swordfish already. I mean, it's still light. You probably could have read a newspaper. It was still, at that time, it gets dark quickly the further south you go, but it was still pretty light. And Oliver grabbed that's the crewman. He grabbed the thing. Yeah, it feels like a sword, it's something whacking it. So he started working it towards the boat. And then by now it's still light enough. I can see the fin of the fish up on the surface. It is a sword, and it's an aggressive one. The bill going frantic, smacking the hell out of this hookless teaser. Got the boat the fish to within casting range. Shouted now, boat went to neutral. Oliver pulled the teaser out. I cast the fly in, and I could see the thing just turn off where the teaser was and just sort of come towards the fly. And I felt boom, on the end of the rod. And that's what I was waiting for, because they hit it with their bill. I just, wait, what do I do? Do I strip? And the Evian just went tight, and I set the hook, and hour and 5 minutes, got the fish. We estimated it 25, 30 kilos, which it was. At the time, the world record, you know, the all tackle fly record was 54 on 10 kilo. So, and it was above that. So
60, 70 pounds?
No, 25 kilos, 55.
Okay.
30 is 66, but it was the high 50s, low 60s. It was over 54 pound, no doubt about it.
Yeah,
and that was on IGFA 20.
That was an IGFA 20. I mean, the fight off this thing. You asked about the fight of the spearfish. I mean,
different gravy.
Swordfish are incredible power wise. They've got the power of a tuna, but you know they fight like a billfish, like a marlin. I mean, as soon as I hook this fish, it's like 30. You know, 10 feet, clear of the waters. So you can see, Jesus, it's a big one, you know. Because a lot of the swords that Vince catches in Madeira are smaller than that. You know, it's a good size one. And the first run was just off the scale. Then he did another run and he went deep. And that's what they do. They go back deep. Then you've got to try and lift them up.
What weight fly rod is it then?
12.
On 12 weights, yeah.
Loomis 12 weight. G Loomis 12 weight.
What reel?
T-ball.
How much line have you got on there?
It's probably 500 yards of back in an 100-foot fly line. Oh, he wasn't going to spool me.
Right, okay.
He wasn't going to spool me. But then they're down and deep. Whereas most billfish fight on or very near the surface. You know, this was like a tuna. It was down, and you know they do this pinwheeling thing. Pinwheel. Well, it wasn't pinwheeling. It was just swimming. And I'm bent over, and I'm in this thing now. I'm just pulling as much as I think I can pull. You know, I've got a fly rod, which is not really a lifting machine, a 9-foot rod. No, it's hooped to the maximum. At the back of the boat, trying to... It's not hooked, because when the rod's hooped, you're not actually putting pressure on the fish. You fight them from the butt. So you had to open the transom door, and I stood at the back then with the rod out, so I can use the actual butt of the rod to put as much pressure on this thing as I could.
Full-length grip or two-grip on the fly rod?
No. A lot of 12 weights have got a four-grip. There's not on this one.
No. I prefer that. I think it's
but the problem with the I've been told this. The problem with a foregrip is that people can use it to put too much pressure on the fish.
Yeah,
you know, you can grab it
too much of a lever. Yeah.
And you can overdo it. But it just went on and on and on, and I started gaining line, and then the fly line, the end of the fly line was back on the reel, and then it was coming, and then the fish is on the surface, and
panic.
We got it. I mean, you know, Olive was out on a swim platform on the outside of the boat, you know, grabbed the bill, and
that's it.
First ever European.
Oh, fucking well done, mate.
Broadbill swordfish on fly, and I'm surprised you didn't hear me screaming.
Yeah, that's amazing, man. That's absolutely amazing.
Is that the pinnacle of what you've done, would you say?
Yes, without a doubt. Never in my wildest, craziest, maddest moments of anything that I think I'd ever catch a swordfish on a fly. I mean, I've had the 1,000-pound plus blue marlin. I've caught all the other billfish species. I've had the 100-pound GTs. I mean, I've had a lot of very, very nice fish, a lot of special fish. But this is
top of the chain.
Well done,
top
mate.
Top of the chain. I mean, there's only five people in the world who've ever caught one on fly.
Well done, mate. That's amazing.
It's just
And they're like,
it's an unbelievable achievement. When you're talking niche.
Yeah, you can keep going niches for the next
hour. I don't think there's a word that, I don't think niche does it justice, does it?
It was just absolutely, totally and utterly off every scale.
Do you think you can cap it, though? Do you think you can one-up it? Is there something else within those wildest dreams?
Well, we're gonna get another one. I mean, again, as a publicity event for Vince, I mean, it's massive. I mean, it's a lot of his business. There's Americans coming over. People who want to catch Royal Slams, broadbill swordfish, 2 hours from, you know, you can go. If you wanted to catch, if a British angler wanted to catch a broadbill swordfish, where can you do it? Okay, you can go to Kenya. Excellent chance you'll get one out on the North Kenya banks. But being realistic, it's going to cost you $4,000. For a week over there and a couple of days fishing. Or you can go to Florida Keys, fishing with a friend of mine, Nicky Stanzik, who's based at, he owns Bud and Mary's Marina. He charges about $3,000
a day. What a place. Yeah.
$3,000 a day.
$3,000 a day and do it there. Or you can fly 2 hours from Bristol to Palm or any other regional airport in the UK, cheap, a reasonably priced flight, 2 hours to Palma, 40 minutes from drive there to Alcudia, and Vince charges in the region of €1,600 a day, which is about £1,000 a day, and that's what you're paying for a lot of UK charter boats now.
Yeah, you are.
And you've got an excellent chance. He charges a bit more for Swordfish because they're longer trips and he's at night. But you've got an excellent chance. To catch one on regular gear.
What's the charter business called?
Mad Max. It's Mallorca Sport Fishing, Mallorca. If you Google Mallorca, Alcudia, big game fishing, or Alcudia, Mallorca. It's Mallorca. What's his company called? My head's gone blank. You'll find him, Vince Riera. The boat is Mad Max. It's out of Alcudia. He's all over the internet. You'll find articles I've written for Marley Magazine, the IGFA, and numerous other publications. Awesome, it's all there. You'll find him.
How did you first meet him?
How did I first? There was an article in Sea Angler, tuna fishing with him. But I was friends with him on Facebook, and then it was the spearfish thing that got me interested. It was the fact that he was catching a lot of these spearfish, and he'd been catching these spearfish all his life. He didn't realise there was any value to them in Mallorca. They're not food fish. They're not interested. So he didn't realise what he had on his doorstep, literally. He had this amazing world-class fishery for the most elusive of the billfish. It's easier to catch a... That's not him.
Oh, is it not?
It's easier to catch a... Catching a broadbill is pretty straightforward on conventional tackle, on conventional equipment. You do it properly, you've got a good chance of catching one. And it's the same in Mallorca. But the spearfish, apart from Hawaii, they get them in the Canaries, they get them in Madeira, they get them in the Azores, Mauritius. But you could fish a year and not see one, or you could go one day and catch one. I mean, I know people who've caught them. They've been marlin fishing in Mauritius or Cape Verde or somewhere, and then a spearfish has come up and taken a lure, and that's how the majority of them get caught. Impossible to target.
Crazy.
Unless you go to Hawaii.
Yeah.
Now at this time of the year. Or fisheries. Just give you an idea. 3 or 4 days ago, the second spearfish was caught on fly. American. The day before that, they raised 7 and caught 5. Tagged and released 5 spearfish in one day. It's unheard of.
And that is as close on our doorstep as we're going to get as
on
well.
On conventional tackle. I mean, these are not big fish. I mean, they're not going to be strapped in a chair and line screaming about it. It's a good
sports fish, though.
It's a great sport fish, but it's just a unique fish to catch, It's a special fish. And anyone looking to, try and get the Royal Slammer billfish, if they want to catch a spearfish, Mallorca. So even Americans on the East Coast, it'd be cheaper for them and quicker for them to get to Mallorca than it would to go to Hawaii.
Hawaii is a ridiculous price to do anything out there. Again, it's an island.
You're going
to
be, I don't know how much you're going to be, but there's no guarantees you're going to get one. I mean, that's where they get good numbers of short-bill spearfish. But, I mean, Vince, he tagged over 100 for the Billfish Foundation last year. And a lot of his fishing is not fishing for these. Most of his fishing is tuna, or amberjacks and other fish, just general tourist trips when they just want to catch something, and they get albacore tuna there and skipjacks, and they get dorado, and they get other species as well.
Good beat you up species for a day on a charter.
Yeah, right? Just for family fishing, but he tagged over 100 for the Billfish Foundation. It's crazy.
How much tuna fishing have you done over here?
I did a couple of days in Ireland. Didn't get one, and I've done a couple of days. I did one with Sam out of Newlyn, And the most productive day I had was with Aaron Lidstone out of Plymouth.
Yeah.
And we had five. And I had my PB, which was 320, something like that. They measured it.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was disappointing because it was on a spreader bar and, you know, the fish was at the boat within 10 minutes. It's,
yeah,
you know, it's just how the rules at the time were, and I understand exactly why they were put in place how they were. I mean, the welfare of a fish you're going to release is everything.
Yeah.
I'm not a tree hugger. I've got no problem with knocking a fish on the head, but if you are going to release a fish, you know, it's got to go back properly. There's nothing to be gained in beating the shit out of something for 2-3 hours, no, letting it go for the, you know, to float to the bottom and die, or the sharks to nail, which is the big problem in the Florida Keys now.
It's getting nailed by sharks.
The shark problem there is horrendous. You know, there's some areas like Boca Grande Pass, which was one of the first really sort of productive areas. I mean, it's just, you know, times of the year, it's unfishable. If you hook a tarpon, it is going to get chopped. You know?
Somebody sent me something about that earlier. I was going to go and try and find it.
It's it's one of those, isn't it? I mean, you've got these fisheries. I guess it's a sign of how much life and what they've got going on over there. But it's when you've got that much of a problem,
it's a sign of the balance of everything that's being
broken. It's an Ernest Hemingway picture, and that was the problem. They were hooking these fish, and the sharks were just coming in and absolutely nailing them.
The Keys, though, I mean, even like there are times of the year and places like Dry Rocks off Key West, which is a famous permit fishery. They've had to put a ban in now to stop people fishing there, because over 50% of the permit hooked are eaten by sharks. I mean, I've caught some nice permit. The biggest permit I ever hooked was fishing a wreck off Almirada out in the Gulf with a guy called Jim Wilcox. He's another Bud and Mary's captain. I hooked this permit on a crab, and it was huge. I mean, it was certainly high 30s. Jim's adamant it was 40 or 40. It was a big fish. It was, you know, it was a slab of a permit. And it's an 8-pound test, and, you know, it's like an hour scrap. And, you know, we got far away from the little bit of structure that they call a wreck that, you know, he said, right, we should be okay now. And we got the boat within landing distance 3 or 4 times, and, you know, they went off again. I mean, they're, you know, pound for pound, they're just incredible things, permit. And they came to the boat, and they went off again, and the next thing is this swirl, and there's this bastard bull shark inhaled my permit, and all you could see was his tail flapping in his mouth. You know, that's what it's like.
And that's the end of
so
that.
So you're not enjoying the fight. I mean, it's, you know,
that's frustrating.
You're under pressure to fight the fish because you know it's going to get chopped. And with a big thing like a tarpon, you don't want to see them being bloody hammered, you know. It's but that's the problem. They've got the Keys now. I mean, all the way up the Keys and all the way up the East Coast, all the way up the West Coast. The West Coast is probably worse in some areas. You know, lemon sharks, bull sharks, tigers, big hammers around those channels around the Keys.
Well, you see the hammers chasing the hooked tarpon. It's crazy. It's, I mean, quite dangerous. And like you said, it's
I'm guessing there's nothing they can do about it. It is what it.
Well, there's something they can do about it, but it's not a very palatable option for a lot of people. Not. It's the whole balance of fishing's been, you know, they got so many issues going. It's still a fantastic place to go and fish, and they still got the best fishing. You know, they call themselves the fishing capital of the world. And in terms of infrastructure and options, you know, you got the blue water options, you got the shallow water. They're still an amazing place to go and fish. And I love it, and I fished it a lot, and I, you know, I'll go every opportunity I get. But they've got a lot of issues there with water quality. Basically, the whole drainage system of the Florida Keys has been messed up. It used to drain north-south from Lake Okeechobee down through the Everglades and the 10,000 islands. The Everglades would filter the water, and it would come out, and it would be beautiful. But then they had to start controlling it for the sugar industry that's based around central Florida. And then they had to have these massive releases of water east and west, forced east and west, out through the Caloosahatchee River on the West Coast, which goes out into Charlotte Harbour, and then Boca Grande, or the St. Lucie River that goes out. It's just north of Fort Lauderdale. And, you know, the kill-offs, you know, the algal bloom. First of all, that, you know, it's toxic. The amount of whatever stuff that was going out there was killing fish and manatees and, you know, horrific sights. But the long-term effect is that it's killing off the grass, you know, the turtle grass, which everything lives on the turtle grass. And, you know, that's where the, you know, the fish used to go.
It's killing off the biosystem.
I was watching one of Andy Mills' podcasts a couple of weeks ago, and there's a guy who's fishing out of the place called the Indian River Lagoon, Banana River Lagoon, which is by Cape Canaveral. I mean, that part of the coast is all part of the intercoastal waterway. When I fished there, it was a fantastic redfish fishery, big redfish, lots of them, catching, you know, trout, which they call trout, but they're actually a type of drum. It was a formality, but all gone. You know, all the grass is gone and everything's gone.
Such a shame.
It's criminal what's happened. But they've got an organisation there now called Captains for Clean Water, and they're very, very active, and they're getting results. The main result is that the Army Corps of Engineers, who sort of did this water management thing that messed everything up, they're doing something to try and
get it back to what it should be.
So the water comes from Okeechobee down through the 10,000 the Everglades, where it's filtered. So much land in America's in Florida has been developed. You know, land that shouldn't have been, you know, same as in this country.
Yeah, I mean,
how many places do you see we're flooding? Well, yeah, I mean, it's flooded. We've had a lot of rain, but the reason it's flooded there is because it's, you know.
Yeah, of course.
It's obvious. It's a floodplain, you know.
Yeah.
And the more concrete you put on the ground, you know, that water's going to go somewhere.
Yeah.
The way I like to describe it, you know, the blocks of oasis that flower arrangers use, you know, like the spongy, hard, foamy stuff that they, you know, you stick the flowers in. If you have a slow dripping tap or a very, you know, slow shower head, and you just pour it on a big slab of that, it's going to absorb it, isn't it? For a long, long time, it's going to absorb all that water.
Yeah.
And if you put a couple of bits of plastic all over the top of it, what's going to start happening?
It's just pulling off.
And if you completely cover it in plastic, that's what happens.
Yeah.
And
I guess that's the what mankind has done to our environment, you know.
I believe in climate change. I mean, the climate is changing. How much of that is down to us, I remain to be convinced. I mean, my argument, I'd like someone to answer why, you know, what happened to the last two ice ages. Why did they, you know, but...
It's global. Elon Musk talks about it. It's global cooling you've got to be worried about, not global warming.
We've messed up so much of the world and, you know, continue to mess it up. And we've been totally aware of what we're doing, but, you just beat yourself with a stick and drive yourself into a corner with it, or...
I mean, fucking hell, there's a whole podcast you could go into just in that, you know?
I think I've got through this one without swearing, mostly, but I couldn't get through that one without swearing, and it wouldn't do my blood pressure any good either.
Something that really bugs you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I get angry about it. I mean, I've seen, you know, my local rivers, you know, and...
I've seen the sewage posts you've done. I have it here.
It's terrible, you know? It's just ignorance. It's not ignorance, because they know what they're doing, and...
It's criminal, that's what it is.
It's criminal, that's exactly what it is. I mean, you got this big thing now with Thames Water and Southern Water. I mean, they've invested nothing in the infrastructure, and this is, you know, like we've had a very wet winter, and they've had to release this water. But the reason they're releasing the water into our, you know, lakes and rivers and reservoirs and the sea, is because they haven't invested the money, and they say, "Oh, we haven't had the money to invest," but they've had billions to give away in share dividends and bonuses for their directors.
Huge. The amount of money that.
I'm not a businessman.
The Southwest Water Lady. 5.1 million last year.
I'm not a businessman, okay? But the way my brain works is, okay, you're running Welsh Water, you're running Thames Water, you're running Southern Water. Money comes in from us.
Taxpayers. Yeah.
Okay, there's your money. Job one, fix the infrastructure. When everything's working 100%, if there's any money left over, you get a bonus. Yeah. You get a bit of a dividend. But, they've spent nothing on it.
They've stripped the money.
You know, they've all had the big, you know, the obscene salaries to start with and the bonuses and the, you know, the shareholders have all had big fat dividends. There was something on the news the other day. It's some French... Something to do with Southern... I'm not convinced... I'm pretty certain it's Southern Water... But they weren't able to do some work that had been scheduled because some French pension investment fund had withdrawn their money. Well, why has a French investment pension fund got any involvement in water in the UK?
Because it's a government backed. It's a government. It's a government backed entity.
The environment should come first, second, third, fourth, fifth. These days, we know what we've done. The environment should.
And we have the capabilities to fix it. This is the thing. We know what we can do.
We know what we're doing.
In a 20-year span, this could be fixed, and we could be in a completely different.
Yeah.
Who knows?
It winds me up. People are sat there. You know, you go to these family dinners and all this sort of stuff, and people are arguing out over Brexit, what's going on in Gaza, and all these sorts of things. Terrible things are happening.
Yeah.
But what's happening to our environment just goes to the bottom of everybody's list, and I can't understand why they're willing to spend. There was some figures that came out that blew my mind recently. How factual they are, but for the price of something like 5 Apache attack helicopters,
yeah,
they could stop. Was it deforestation in the Amazon?
It was, isn't it?
But they're willing to send.
It's all money.
They're quite happy to send that out into Iraq, into Afghanistan, that sort of money for that equipment.
But here's another example. You asked me earlier how the drive down was. Okay. Yeah. It's May, almost June.
Yeah.
Late spring, early summer.
Yeah.
Okay. I drove from South Wales all the way down through Somerset, Devon,
yeah,
down to here, through a lot of beautiful countryside. Within my childhood, the windscreen of the car would have been covered in dead bugs, flies and insects and what have you. And, if a lot of places around the world, that's what happens. Okay? It happens in France. We go on holiday in France and you get covered in, I don't think a single fly at the windscreen. And that,
I remember as a kid.
Yeah. You can't get them off the number plate.
When I was a kid, the summers, every house with a V-Apex would have a house martin nest under it.
We've got them in my dad's garage out in Stoke Gabriel.
They'd be swallows. Right, okay. There'd be swallows inside the garage, but again, and swifts, but you don't see them now. And the reason you don't see them is because the insects are gone. These are wing feeders, they feed on insects. And I get frustrated because you get all these people, they watch the David Attenborough programs, oh, this is sad, this is terrible. And then the next week they go out and, sort of green fly are having a go at their roses. So they go to B&Q and they get a can of bloody chemicals and they spray. Where do they think those chemicals are going to end up?
Yeah.
In the water.
In the water courses. You might as well just go to a bridge and just pour it off a bridge, Save the, fast track it.
Yeah.
But that's what's happening. We're putting so much. I mean, algal blooms at sea, another example. We used to get May water, it used to last maybe a week, and the first bit of wind or the first set of spring tides, it'd be gone. It lasts for weeks now.
Yeah. There's something going on up at Eastbourne? There's a lad called Jake, mussel fishing. I was talking to him and he was saying they've got a problem up there at the moment. It's just unfishable.
Yeah, the May rot.
Yeah, the May rot. Yeah,
you can smell it. You can smell it. I mean, I was out off Weymouth a couple of years ago and you're fishing a wreck.
Get it in your braid.
And he was on the braid.
Yeah.
He was like, what's this? He's like, well, it's just filth. Yeah. And it's the phosphates and the nitrates. And we're all responsible because every time you put your washing machine on, there's all this stuff that's in, the washing powder. It's all phosphates, nitrates or whatever it eats. And it all ends up in the water course.
Mm.
But then you're back to the water management companies who are not managing it. And,
this stuff's going in there.
But there we are.
I guess that's one of the many battles that as anglers, we're going to see all the time. We're on the water in the times when people aren't seeing it. We're going to the places that people aren't necessarily openly seeing, general public. And
The whole reason, the whole reason that this has become so topical in recent years is down to the pandemic, when everyone wanted to go swimming and they wanted to go out, they couldn't go abroad and all that. They wanted to go to the rivers. There's a bloody tampon floating down the river. Oh, there's a used condom.
Yeah.
Anglers have been whining about this
for years,
for decades.
Yeah.
And nobody's done a thing, but because, It's a good thing that people are going out and doing it and seeing it and becoming aware of these problems.
Hopefully we can see some improvements. I think we're a long way off, but
we're a long way off.
The more eyes on the water.
That's the problem.
Yeah. I don't want to sound like a. I am. When it comes to this sort of thing, I can't help but be pessimistic. I mean, in my lifetime, When I was growing up, the Welsh valleys, most of the rivers were black, you know, totally polluted, all the mines and the steelworks and you know, everything, all the industry associated with them, totally polluted the rivers. Whereas you come outside the valleys into Monmouthshire or Carmarthenshire, and you had the, you know, the Towy and the Tyvee and the River Usk and the River Wye near where I am, beautiful rivers, pristine, full of fish, full of life. And it's completely reversed now. The industrial, once industrial rivers are full of trout, they got fantastic runs of salmon and sea trout in the Taff and the Rumney, and grayling, you know, are thriving in these rivers. These are rivers that were fishless when I was a kid. But the Usk and the Wye, I mean, the Wye is in an appalling state.
Yeah.
Because mass chicken farming. I forget how many mass poultry farms there are, but these things are producing millions and millions of birds, and millions of birds produce tons and tons of bird shit.
Yeah.
What do we do with the bird shit? Oh, we put it on the land, fertilizer. Oh, great. You know, this sounds sustainable.
Then you get runoff and it's in the water.
Then you've got runoff and it ends up in the water. So it's not a case of you've got a couple of local poultry farms, you know, and you know, a bit of fertilizer. I mean, there's tons and tons and tons of the stuff, and the Wye now runs green. And then, you know, it's sad.
Very sad. We've only got a little bit of land on this island, and it should be looked after a hell of a lot better. That's a whole other thing.
Right, guys. Well, I think we've covered pretty much everything.
There's only so much of this I can drink.
Yeah, and the Indian's going to shut soon. We need to go and get some beer inside.
It's quarter to nine.
Yeah, we've been yabbering. How long have we been going for? 3 hours.
Is that too long?
No, mate. I could listen for another three. Yeah. We're going to carry this on in the boozer in a minute. Don't worry.
Come on,
then. Anyway, thanks, guys.
Yeah. Thank you, mate, for coming down. I appreciate you. Thanks like for all of this. This has just been, I've just been sat here quiet, most of it, because it's like having an audio book. So if someone wants to copy your book, where can they pick this up?
Email me, david.lewis21@hotmail.com. You'll find my email. Just Google Dave Lewis Fish and you'll find me online. And
we can put a link into the podcast, can't we, for that?
Yeah,
there'll be a link in the podcast.
David.lewis21@hotmail.com. I think I've got about a couple of dozen copies of that left.
Brilliant. Can I give this one away?
Yeah, sure you can.
So what we'll do is, so when this podcast goes out, we'll do a whole, I don't know what we'll do. We'll do a like and share of some description, and we'll put this up as a prize. Your podcast might be going back, so I'm going to read it first. So you've got absolutely no chance. It's a lovely book.
I'll bring you down a copy next time I come.
Brilliant. Perfect. Yeah. Well, I'll see you next week then. That'll be
fine. Guys. Well, thank you very much. Cheers, Dave. It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Likewise.
Good to see you, mate.
Mate, I really appreciate that. Good. If you can go and for all the listeners out there, all eight of you, if you could, eight. Well, we might be on nine after that.
Might be hitting double figures.
Well, we might hit 11 because Henry Gilby was on after this one. I think we're going to go well up into the 30s. But if you could go to YouTube, go and subscribe. Come find us on Facebook.
Is there anything else you need to tell them, Aaron? Is that it?
Yeah,
Tuna Gear website, you can find it on there as well, as long as there's some really cool tackle. We'll see you on the next one. Let's go to the pub. Speckled Hen time. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.